Welcome to the latest episode of Your Wealth with Gemma Dell, a podcast series designed to help you create, grow, and protect your wealth.
Hi, and welcome to Your Wealth. I'm Gemma Dell, NAB Trades Director of SMSF and Investor Behaviour. We've discussed exchange-traded funds regularly on this podcast, and they remain one of the most popular investments for investors on NABTrade, especially for our younger investors who see them as a great way to get started in the market. What we've also mentioned is that ETFs are not just a buy and hold option. They can actually offer trading strategies for investors who are keen to play a particular theme or a strategy with their portfolios. Today, I've got Chris Walesby, head of ETF securities in Australia, to talk us through some of the strategies you could consider when using ETFs in your portfolio. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Gemma.
So Chris, you've mentioned before the origin of ETFs as a way for fund managers to effectively make sure they've got the market return before they start picking specific stocks, so they're taking positions after a while. Is that a good place to start a conversation about ETF trading strategies?
Yeah, it is, because that is actually, as you said, the origin of ETF usage. When people say trading, there's always the view that trading is short-term, but what is short-term? And short-term can be anything from intraday to 3 months. For some portfolio managers, short-term is actually a year. So in this case, it was key fund managers in the States who, rather than picking stocks when they wanted to get, you know, a general market recovery move, they decided, actually, why don't we just track the index, because we don't care about what the individual stock performance is. And in fact, which I'll come on to in a minute, we actually think that it's risky to pick specific stocks on a recovery trade. We just want to get what's called, you know, in the market, the beta of the market. So basically just the upswing without any specific stocks. And what's interesting is in Australia, ETFs are only starting to be used for that reason right now. So as we've discussed, Gemma, ETFs are generally buy and hold instruments for Australian investors. And actually, globally, that's the primary reason that they're used and probably always will be. But as time goes on within each country, people get more confident about the different capabilities of ETFs and how they can be used. And because they're a fund structure on exchange, it does mean that they can also be used for shorter term trading strategies. Let's just take an example. So what happened in August with the massive sell-off, you know, the S&P ASX 200 went down from 6.4 to 5.4 thousand. And in that situation, many Australians knew that that was probably what we call oversold. So, you know, people were panicked and sold down the stock market too much. Now, traditionally in Australia, stock pickers will obviously pick stocks to play the recovery because they feel that these stocks are, you know, now undervalued and they will go up. But which stocks are going to do that and which aren't? So if you'd pick BHP, that would have recovered and it's exceeded where it was in August. But something like ANZ and many of the other banks and other, you know, industries, these companies haven't achieved it. Whereas if you had just taken the ASX 200 tracker, you would have made 20% over 4 or 5 months without having to pick one stock at all.
That's a really good point. And I think a lot of our investors were really excited about the sell-off in August, that started in August anyway. It was a nice opportunity for a lot of people who had been sitting on the sidelines with a bucket load of cash waiting for an opportunity. But as you say, they did buy. Certainly there was a lot of buying of banks and there was a lot of buying of some of the things that did not come back so strongly. So your example is a good one. So do you think when we look at trading strategies, do you think you need a reasonably good understanding of how ETFs work before you consider trading them? Should you have tried holding them as a buy and hold strategy first, or is it not really that complex?
Well, I guess there's probably a couple of rules. You don't really need to have a strong understanding of all the mechanics of how ETFs work. ETFs are a bit of a weird one because they are simple, but there are things that are happening underneath the bonnet that sometimes confuse people and frighten people. But really, they're just funds that trade on exchange. So in terms of the understanding of the ETFs from a trading perspective, particularly if you want to do better at trading ETFs, the key things what the primary point to understand is that ETFs, even though they trade on exchange, they're not stocks. So stocks have a limited supply, unless there's any new placements in the market, but there are a limited supply of the stocks. So the price is dictated absolutely by demand and supply. Whereas with ETFs, ETFs are wrappers that track underlying stock markets or bond markets or commodity markets. So you cannot move the market unless you have absolutely enormous size trades. And I'm talking about, you know, $150, $200 million in one trade, which most people don't have. And the reason is because when you're buying that ETF, let's just say it's tracking the ASX 200, you are actually buying all 200 of the ASX 200 stocks in little amounts. So your trade is not going to move the price of those underlying stocks, right? So that's one of the things that we always see is that people who are very good or very experienced or both at stock trading is that they believe that if they show their size, like big size, if they have enough size to trade on exchange, that they try and split it into parcels because they don't want, you know, standard stock things, which are actually true for stocks. They don't want the market maker to see that they have a big order and therefore move the price up so that you have to chase the price, right? With the ETF, the price is literally derived by the underlyings and you as an investor, you're not going to move it. So, you know, things like, as I said, parceling up trades, that's not really, you know, required. The other thing is that we also get investors that are frustrated that sometimes there aren't market makers on screen all the time, right? So the reason I raise this is not to shy away from that fact because it actually happens, but it's more to explain why it's the case. And further down, you know, the line of this discussion, I'll explain ways to mitigate this. But the market makers are making markets generally in multiple ETFs, you know, hundreds, sometimes thousands of ETFs with all the different inputs that are coming in. So you may be looking at one particular ETF as an investor, but from the market maker's perspective, not that this means it's right, but they are looking at many with a lot of different inputs in there. And one of those inputs is something happens in the market that they don't understand. And basically creates uncertainty. The computer programs that the market makers use normally have defensive postures. So they basically go, if I don't understand what's happened, I will make the spreads for an investor to buy go wider, or I'll actually pull my prices altogether until I understand the situation. So what does that really mean? It means that, say, you get an announcement that, you know, the Prime Minister of Australia has, you know, resigned.
Been knifed again.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Or honestly, you know, 9/11, when that happened, right? So that will cause, you know, if that happens whilst the Australian stock market is open, that will cause uncertainty. Or more innocuously, things like BHP decides to try and, you know, take over Fortescue, right? Now people don't know what the price of BHP is and what the price of Fortescue is, and actually the ASX may suspend both of those companies for a period of time whilst they work out you know, what the actual trading statement is. For a market maker, that is uncertainty, so they will express that by either increasing the spreads to express that uncertainty, or if they really don't understand it, putting the price for a short period of time.
Can you just explain what you mean by spread for people so they understand what the implications are for them?
Absolutely. So with an ETF, just like a stock, there are two elements. There's the price and then there's, so let's just say with stock or ETF X, the price is $10. But actually it'll cost you, say, $10.02 to buy. That's the offer price. Or $9.98. To sell, and that's the spread. So what it really means is if you bought something at 10.02 and you immediately wanted to sell it, you'd actually lose 4 cents, all things being equal. Even though the stock or the ETF is still $10, you would have lost 4 cents just by buying and selling it.
Purely the transaction cost.
Yeah, and it's and exactly, and it's how the market makers make money, and it's just called, we call it in the industry, spread.
Okay. And so in the scenario you've described, things are a little bit wobbly for one reason or another, and there may be totally legitimate reasons. It's nothing wrong with the market as such, but there's some uncertainty and those spreads start to widen, so you're paying a higher transaction cost
exactly.
in that situation.
That's exactly right.
Right, so that is going to be one of the things that people need to take into consideration when they're trading. If it's a long-term buy and hold, you're less worried about your spread, right? Because it's going to take quite some time before you're selling it. You know, if it's 2 to 3 years, that 4 cents isn't going to bother you too much. But if it's a couple of days, that's quite meaningful in terms of what impact it has on your return.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like if you're looking at a 10-year horizon, it sort of fades into insignificance. But you can have situations where, let's just say the primary market makers, and they're normally more than one, but they're the professionals, right? But they are also, even though they don't speak to each other in any capacity, they probably have similar reasons for pulling their prices, right? We just named examples before. But what you can have is market orders that are in there that are significantly away. So it can be, you know, 2 or 3% away from the actual price. So even though that's going to fade into the background over a long period, it still leaves a bit of taste in the mouth for anyone who suddenly gets what we call executed, but transacted at a price that is, you know, significantly further away. They've had to pay 2% more when the price 3 seconds ago was, you know, 2% less. So it's just, you know, these things, it's no one ETF provider's fault. It's not the market maker's fault either. It's just they're not stocks and they just need to be approached differently.
So you'll talk in a minute about some ways to mitigate that risk, yeah. which is quite useful for people. One place to start though, so not all ETFs have similar attributes. You're obviously looking at different markets and different types of securities that you want to get exposure to. What sort of ETFs are most popular for trading rather than investing? I'll give the example on NabTrade, certainly. We see a lot of trading, active trading, in gold ETFs or US dollar ETFs, for example, where people are wanting to take a position in the short term because they believe that there is going to be some either hedging, so they're trying to protect their portfolio, or because they're going to believe there's going to be some movement.
Yeah, so it's a great question, because this goes back to what we were saying before about what are trading strategies as opposed to investment strategies, and actually there's a significant blur. The only thing that you can know for certain is investment strategies that are over a long horizon are true investment strategies, where you're not probably going to change things very much, but you know, you may, as you say, have a short-term view, which is actually 6 months. To others, that would be an investment strategy. But if we just take the products, you know, the ones that generally people are looking at are ones that are volatile. Now, volatility means the amount, the aggression of price moves. So if a stock price goes up by 10% one day and then goes down by 10% the next day, and you compare it to another stock that goes up 1% and down 1%, the first one is 10 times more volatile than the second one. Now, volatility is sometimes considered by people to be a bad word, because if you have negative volatility, so things go down aggressively, you can lose a lot of money. Investors are very scared of that. And volatility can also be your friend. So if you're a short-term trader and you've looked into a particular set of products, you mentioned gold, you mentioned the US dollar, a lot of people trade technology stocks for the same reasons. They are actually trading them because they believe that those stocks have got a high ability to increase in price very quickly. So that's why they select them. So gold is a perfect example. Silver is an even better example on the commodity side alone, because silver is considered to be the volatile, the more volatile version of gold. People are expecting big bounces. So when they go into them, they're expecting to make 5 to 10% in a very, very short period of time. It could be a week, it could be a month. And if you think that the standard portfolio return is, you know, 6 or 7% a year, This is what people are doing. They're taking very small positions to try and get this accelerated return. US dollar, now that's not so much about volatility because people think currencies are volatile, but currencies are actually really not volatile at all. In a company that I worked at back in the UK, we had a lot of currency ETFs, and we actually had to convert them all to three times the leverage because they just weren't volatile enough for our clients, because historically they're not.
Just boring. Yeah. Unless it's the Aussie dollar, where it's gone from 50 US cents to $1.10 back to 70 cents in the space of
slowly.
A decade.
Yeah, slowly from a trading point of view. So, but the point there is that everyone knows the Aussie dollar, US dollar. So you've got two reasons why people pick products. So it's great that you mentioned the US dollar. One is having a high chance of getting big returns. And the other is because people are familiar with it. Again, we spoke very briefly about technology, but there's, you know, two main ETFs that cover technology in Australia. That's the tech ETF that ETF Securities have that we have, and also NDQ, which is tracks the NASDAQ that BTS have. And people are using those actually even if it, for short term or for long term, because they believe that there's going to be a high potential for growth. Buy and hold investors, it's for a longer term. You know, they're hoping to make, you know, 100% over 5 years. For a short term investor, they're looking to see a sell off like August, come back in December and make 20% on a recovery. So it's the same foundation, just different time perspectives.
I think that's a really useful point for people, because if you look at the ASX 200, you're probably not getting that volatility. And for that is the number one. Interesting, I do get this question actually, why is it that we see so much investing in the ASX 200 as an ETF and not offshore? We know that everyone's massively overweight the ASX anyway, but it's what we see. So yeah. Via NavTrade, we see people buying the ASX first and then they will look to diversify offshore, often starting with ETFs.
So every country is the same. That's the thing. Like, it's the same in the UK, it's the same in America.
Apparently the Dutch are not. I have heard that the Dutch only hold 1% of their portfolio in domestic stocks and everything else is offshore.
Really?
Well, not offshore. They're landlocked. Everything else is international. But the Dutch are very unusual.
Yeah, well, the Dutch come from trading backgrounds, so they're probably slightly more astute on that type of stuff. Yeah.
Well, they've got Royal Dutch Shell and they've got a couple of like mega companies there as well. It's not like they've got nothing to invest in.
No.
ING is a Dutch company. Many others that are worth noting. So, yeah, it's quite funny that they've got that approach.
Yeah, but I know that some of the Dutch, they're the savviest, you know, traders there are. Like, it's like Chicago in America and New York. That in Europe, the main, the history, like, you know, the Tulip crisis and stuff like that, that's all Dutch. Mm. So for 500 years, they've had ships, you know, arriving and trading with them. So these guys have got, they're pretty clued up as to diversification and things like that.
Yes. Dutch East India Company, for example. Okay, so let's talk about what sort of investment objectives can be achieved using ETFs. So what would you be trying to achieve if you were looking at some trading strategies?
Okay, so the two ones I wanted to talk about today, just for simplicity, because there are many. The first one is directional. So we talked at the very beginning about market recovery trades. So I'm not going to repeat that, but that is basically where you see that the market sold off and you're looking for an upward return, either taking the entire index, or you can also take sector funds. So some providers like VanEck and BetaShares have sector funds that cover banks, they cover resources, they cover gold miners. So if you have a specific view on that, you don't have to take the individual companies, you don't have to take ANZ or Commonwealth, you can just take the sector. Then you have shorting. Now, just like volatility, the word shorting in investment circles gets bad coverage, but from what's called a market efficiency point of view, shorting is one of the best things available for investors when they think that the market is, again, overbought, so when it's too high. Because in that situation, you can either take a directional bet that the market's going to fall, and short ETFs will allow you to capture positive returns when the market falls. So, you know, you don't have to sell your stocks and just go into cash, which you can actually benefit from the downward move. And actually, a lot of people use these types of ETFs, and there are, you know, six or eight of them on the Australian Stock Exchange now. But they use them to hedge, and hedging means when they protect the downfall in their portfolio, or reduce the downfall. So here they may have a number of stocks in their portfolio, but rather than sell them, they want to hold on to them, but they'll use the ETF to temporarily short the market. So basically benefit from the decline, which hopefully offsets what they've lost on their stock positions. So it just avoids having to sell everything that you've got, move it into cash, and then try and time the market to come back in. You can just use this, and when the time's right, you just sell the short position, and then everything, you know, goes back to normal. So people use it for hedging strategies. And then the other thing for direction is that there are leveraged ETFs as well. So leverage also, this is getting much more punchy, and not for the faint-hearted, and definitely not for people who are, you know, traditionally buy and hold investors. But these are for people who have short-term views, right? And the leverage is, so what it means is that if the ASX 200 goes up by 1%, that day you will get 2% if it's a 2x leverage, or if it's a 3x leverage, you get 3x. So these are very effective for short-term recoveries if you get it right, but obviously you will lose 3x as much as well. But there are many, especially on the professional investor side, that like these types of product, because the view is, and you said before, the ASX 200 might not be volatile enough. Some people believe, okay, well, I'm trained or educated enough to take that risk, and therefore I will. Now, for the more traditional investor, the second trading strategy is more around sort of core satellite. So that refers to either being a core part of a portfolio or a satellite part of the portfolio. So here, I'm assuming that the core of the portfolio for many of your clients stroke investors, Gemma, is probably stocks. So here what you're doing with the ETF is you're using it as what we call a satellite, but basically it's a small short-term tilt towards something. And we've already used the examples before. So if you thought that the banks were heavily sold off during the Royal Commission, which they were, and there was a particular point in time where you thought, okay, I think banks are going to recover. I don't know which bank. In fact, I think it's going to be all of them. So you just take a bank sector ETF and you put it into your portfolio for 5% or 6% for a short period of time, hoping that that accelerates your returns, right? It's not affecting your core portfolio. It's a peripheral trade to sort of enhance the return.
That's a really cool idea, for a lot of people, because many of our investors do have these sorts of short-term ideas they want to take advantage of. On your point about leverage and short ETFs, some of our investors do, because they can trade offshore, so access to the US, the UK, Germany, and Hong Kong directly, will buy leverage shorts in the US via ETFs at 3x the daily pricing. So those ones are not for the faint-hearted. You want to know exactly what you're doing. But investors who feel confident that they can take a position on what US markets are going to do, or particular prices as well. They'll go with some commodity prices. They'll be looking for those. There's an enormous range that people are buying over there.
I can actually give a direct tip on that, because a lot of people, the leverage products in Australia don't work like this. So this is caveated that it's in reference to the American and the European leverage products. And without going into a lot of details, but because they reset daily, so they're called daily reset products, right? The general rule is, if your product is trending down or trending up, if you're on the right side of the trade, say you're on a 3x short and the market's going down, it will continue to work for you as you expect it to do. So if it goes down 3%, you make 9%. If it goes down 3% the next day, you'll make another 9%, et cetera, et cetera. As soon as the, and this is just the maths talking, right? Because that's how daily resets work. The people on your on this recording will just have to take my word for it, but you can go onto people's websites and do the maths yourself. As soon as they start to become range bound, so they don't take a direction down, as soon as they start to go up one day, down the next day, up one day, next day, you will lose money. So you need to be in them only when the trend is continuing to go the direction you want it to do. As soon as it sort of starts to stall, that's when you need to be coming out of that. And as I said, it's mathematical. You can look at it on a calculator. That's how they work. I don't want to talk about that too much here because it will confuse people, but that's the general rules. If it's going your way, hold on to it, and as soon as it starts to stall or run out of steam, come out.
That's an excellent point. I think there'll be some people listening who'll be taking notes on that one, and we'll have a little look at what our guys are doing as well, whether that is how they're playing those ones. It's a range of different markets and commodities often that they're playing, so you want to watch them closely. But
commodities is a different one, because there's things that, I don't know again if it's right for here, but there's, with the commodities, you don't just have the stock price movement up and down, but you have things called backwardation and contango. And these are the way that lots of commodities are structured, where actually the future price is significantly higher or significantly lower than the current price you're in. So you actually have a double whammy there, where if you're not trading just with the trend, you can actually lose a lot of money when the commodities roll from one future to another. So maybe that's for
we'll have a look at that in another time, I imagine. We'll go away and do some work on what our guys are doing. Yeah. Have a look at which particular securities they're going after, which particular themes they're following, and what their strategies are. It'll be quite interesting. Yeah. So one of the points you made earlier was about the market maker and how they behave in a dislocated market.
Yep.
And there appear to be very specific ways you can avoid being caught just by the nature of the product and the way the market works. How do you do your best to ensure you're getting what you pay for?
Well, there are a couple of things, and all these things will hopefully make sense after I explain them. We've got some questions here. Hopefully they just, they come, there's two or three questions in one that I'm hoping to answer here. But one of them is, if you can, you trade the underlying markets when they're open. So let's just say that you are wanting to buy a Japanese ETF in Australia. For the first couple of hours of the day, the Japanese market is not open, right? So that means that there is, to that point about uncertainty, the market makers have heightened uncertainty because they don't know what is actually happening in Japan. They can only predict it based on a number of different inputs, including the Japanese futures. But the point is, they don't actually know definitively what is happening because it hasn't opened yet, right? So Japan was shut for the last week, and that's been the case there. So anyone who's been trading Japan has been trading off a completely closed market for a week. Now, all that means is, and we've already sort of discussed this before, is that the market makers don't know what the prices are, so therefore they make it more expensive to buy to reflect that uncertainty. Now, there are lots of underlying stock markets that just aren't open in Australian time. So some it's more, less relevant. But there are many, stocks, especially in Asia, that if you wait just, up until lunchtime, trade it after lunchtime, then you're going to have much better transaction costs. The transaction costs will be reduced. There is one caveat to that. And there is what we spoke about before. There's the price of the ETF, and then there's the transaction cost. If you genuinely believe that the price will be significantly higher in 2 or 3 hours, then it's not worth waiting just to, save a couple of cents on the transaction costs if you think it's going to be $2 more. But all things being equal, if you don't think there's going to be a change in the price, you can reduce your transaction costs by trading when the underlying markets are open. You can also, well, one of the biggest trading tips that I can give is to use limit orders. So limit orders avoid many of the problems of having market makers drop out. And the reason why is because you don't get executed above the limit. So the worst case scenario that you can have, and for some it's not a nice thing, but is you just don't, your trade isn't done.
Yeah.
So no one
hits. You just get cleared out.
Yeah, exactly. So it just, you know, it just deletes itself overnight and you have to replace it in, but at least you didn't pay 2% over the odds or 3% over the odds. So I've been recommending for, you know, a decade to use limit orders, and I'm not the only ETF fund manager who does. We all standardly do because it, no pun intended, it limits your ETF trading risk because you're controlling the point at which you can trade, and it means that you don't get any arbitrary, unusual activity that, you know, can be negative for you. The other big tip is not to trade at the open or close ever, unless you're a professional investor. So wait 10 minutes either side. And the reason there is, again, uncertainty. So a lot of people don't realize this, but you know, on the ASX, not all stocks open at the same time. So depending on where they are in the alphabet, they open, you know, at different times. So the market makers are taking in all of these inputs, right? So, you know, BHP opens before Rio, but Rio isn't open yet. So they have to allow all that to come in, and then, you know, let the initial market calm down a bit, because it's very volatile when the market's open or into the close. And once all those inputs are sort of, you know, known, and the immediate sort of franticness of the open or close is done, it's a more settled market, and that will be reflected in the transaction costs, which will reduce massively after that. So again, absolutely unlike a stock, where a lot of the best bargains and deals are in the open or the auction, with ETFs, just steer clear.
Sit tight.
Yeah.
That's an awesome tip. I think many people go into ETFs understanding the long-term story because they want to get exposure to a market and they're thinking about that long-term story. So they just place an order in a very calm fashion, right? This is a long-term investment for me. I'll just put it on, you know, I'll put it on when I open my trading account in the morning and I'll let it go. Not thinking about having a limit on it, not thinking about the timing at which it's going into the market and all those sorts of things, because it's a long-term investment. Obviously, for traders, it's more important to, you've got to limit your transaction costs if you're trying to make a short-term profit. But for those who are trying to make a longer-term profit, you want to limit your transaction costs as well, right?
Yeah, I mean, actually, all ETF providers that I know of in Australia, they will have something called a capital markets team. Mm-hmm. And that capital markets team exists. I used to work on capital markets teams in Europe precisely for this reason, because, you know, there are many, many studies mainly done in Europe and America, because as we said at the beginning, the short-term trading of ETFs in Australia is only really starting now. But you can actually see, it's called the total cost of ownership, but you can actually see that you can lose huge amounts when you're, it's not just trading ETFs, it's also trading stocks. Because most people don't consider their transaction costs. They just don't. So they're, you know, with a fund, they'll look at the MER and go, well, that's 0.4%. That's better than the one that's the 0.5%, right? But what if the one with the 0.4% has got, you know, only one market maker, and that market maker, for whatever reason, is not present that much around that particular product? Whereas the one that's 0.5 has got three or four market makers, and the cost to trade, you can trade whenever you want with ease, and it doesn't cost much, right? People don't factor that in, but the ETF providers have spent a lot of time helping clients reduce their transaction costs, because it's a very easy saving. You know, for advanced trades, it's a bit more difficult, but on the whole, some of these tips will save people, you know, 0.2%, 0.3%, 0.4% every time they trade. So it's worth, you know, listening, because, you know, lots of ETFs are very cheap, and but the transaction costs go unnoticed. They can sometimes be three times what the management expense ratio is.
It's really material as well, right? So if you are buying something just to track the market, the only way to ensure you get as close to the market return as possible is to manage your costs. That's the sole variable you can manage, other than ensuring you've got somebody who is actually tracking the market. Yeah. That's kind of
derogate. Yeah.
Chris, you produce a lot of content on this sort of stuff. I think a lot of people take it for granted that, you know, once people get their heads around the sort of fundamentals of the product, they don't do too much digging. And this has been brilliant just to explain some of the simple things you can do to ensure you get the most out of them. Where can people go to make sure they keep up to date with all the stuff you're publishing on this kind of thing?
Well, for us, ETF Securities, on our website, we have in our sort of research and learning section something called the ETFAQ. And that's actually, it's got a significant amount of detail on trading, on the things that we discussed today, and the mechanics about how they work. But it's also more broadly, like, you know, how ETFs work in general. So for those people who are listening to this recording, who truly want to understand a bit more about what's going on, they can actually ring us up and we can go through it. But this document is about 20 pages, and it details, you know, many of the things, you know, tries to demystify a lot of the things around ETFs that are going on, including trading. And actually, as I said before, most providers have similar style booklets. But I would also encourage people to call the providers as well, be it us at ETF Securities. We've got 6 salespeople that are always there taking calls from, you know, your investors, Gemma, and others. But when you talk to providers, we never get enough calls, because people feel, oh, I don't want to appear stupid, or et cetera, et cetera. We know what it feels like to be on the other side, not knowing. We've you know, helped lots of people go through this stage. So there's the learning, and then there's just pick up a phone or send an email and someone will call you and go through it.
That's awesome. You may be the first person who said pick up the phone and call me directly, but that's perfect. People love it. Chris, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you again, Gemma.
And as always, thank you so much for joining us and listening to this episode of the podcast. We hope it's been helpful in your journey to creating wealth. We always love to hear from you, and Chris from ETF Securities has said he does too. If you have any feedback or suggestions for future topics, please just email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au. I'm Gemma Dale. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Your Wealth with Gemma Dale. To stay up to date, please subscribe to this podcast series or email us at yourwealth@nab.com.au.
Please note that any advice provided in this podcast has been prepared without taking into account your objectives, financial circumstances, or needs. Before acting, you should consider the appropriateness of the information. To find out more, please visit nab.com.au.